As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hi, I'm Matt Lieb.
And I'm Vince Mancini.
And this is Pod Yourself a Gun, a Sopranos podcast where Vince Mancini and I go through every single episode of The Sopranos and talk about it. We very much thank you all for being here and, of course, for giving us 5 stars in review on the Apple Podcast app or store or whatever. I did see a few messages from people who told us, hey, Matt, we would love to do that, but we use Android devices and therefore they can't do it. So I understand that some of you use Androids and you can't do it. But you know what? You can always
make like a picture macro of us and put it on 8chan or whatever the fuck Android people do.
Yeah. Whatever you weirdo Android people do with your better phones than we have, feel free to do it. Just as long as you somehow figure out a way to show.
I have access to my root files.
That's what they sound like.
Yeah.
They're always talking about their root files. I don't give a shit, dude. Just show me where the internet is. That's what I say.
Does internet?
Yeah, which button shows me my stock market portfolios? Speaking of which, I bought... I don't know why I'm talking about this now, but I made the mistake of buying stock recently, and weed needs to be legal soon because that stock is just plummeting for no reason. Mm. It's like weed stock. Anyways, so if you're out there and you can't give us 5 stars in a review, buy some stock in weed. It'll help raise the price so I can sell and never buy stock again. All right. Ladies and gentlemen, today, our guest is a returning champion of Pod Yourselves a Gun, someone who has been on a previous episode. You know her, you love her, from the Hollywood Crime Scene podcast. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back, Rachel Fisher.
Hello, thanks for having me back.
Oh, thank you for coming back. We really appreciate it. How have you been?
I've been well. I moved recently, so that's exciting. And, just hanging out in quarantine still.
Still in quarantine.
Did you get any quarantine over here?
You got a shot yet? Any of the shots?
I did. I got my second shot last week.
Wow.
Yeah.
Congrats.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Does that mean you're 1 week away from being able to go outside again?
Yeah. Yeah. I'm a week away from trying to remember how to dress for normal situations.
Yeah.
I kind of I was one of those people that definitely became a hermit.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was really easy because like I work from home.
Yeah.
Why would I have to leave?
No, I feel you. I feel you. I also was just like, hey, everyone has to be inside. Perfect. This is, gives me a reason to isolate completely, to not keep up with anybody who I know.
Yeah.
And
I've already trained for this with the heroin.
Yeah, I've been an addict before. I know how to stay inside and be sad. So that is not a problem for me.
I agree.
Yeah. And speaking of which, we brought you on this episode specifically because I always said if we ever get to the episode with the intervention, I need to have Rachel Fisher on because you and I are both in recovery. And I was like, this is a perfect, perfect guest for every time Chris reaches another step in the recovery relapse process. You know?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. So.
So did you, since coming on this podcast last, did you start rewatching The Sopranos all the way through and get super into it?
Well, I realized there were so many things that I had like forgotten the trajectory of, like, for example, Ralphie eating it. Yeah. I was like, oh, that's happened already. So, you know, I...
So you didn't. You're telling me you didn't rewatch right after you...
I rewatched the episode. Yes.
Oh, that's good.
I rewatched the episode, of course, because it's been a while since I've seen the whole series.
Right, right. I guess you've already seen it. You don't need to rewatch it. I take pride in every time someone comes on this pod and they're like, hey, now I'm rewatching it. And I don't know why I take pride in it. I didn't write The Sopranos, but I have a lot of stock in that. I don't know why. But yeah, no, I'm glad to have you back.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, no, thanks for coming back. And as you know, and the audience knows, before we get started with this episode, we must first listen to the theme song. Pod. 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 Podcast. Pod. 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 Podcast. All right.
Yeah.
Hell
now we're
yeah.
ready.
Now we're excited for it. We were dancing the whole time. Ladies and gentlemen and everyone, today we are going to be talking about, from season 4 of The Sopranos, episode 10, The Strong Silent Type, which premiered November 17th, 2002. Vince, why don't you break us off a little piece of that synopsis?
In the midst of suspicions that he killed Ralph, I don't know why I said suspicions. Let me try that again. Weirdo. In the midst of suspicions that he killed Ralph, Tony tries to intervene and get Chris clean and sober.
Yeah. All right. That was it's a little rhyming. I don't know why.
Sure. That's a synopsis, sort of.
That's a synopsis. Yeah. And so, Vince, what was happening at the time that this episode premiered?
Oh, I mean, I think what you're trying to say is that you cannot evaluate art outside of its cultural context.
You know I'm not. You know what I'm saying?
and, you know, for that, we go to the Remember When machine.
Walk, walk.
Remember. Remember when it's the lowest form of conversation.
That's right. So for this episode, for the Remember When machine, we're going all the way back to November 17th, 2002. It was a Sunday. A lot of stuff was happening. You know, for these, I try to get couple headlines that are like serious and show sort of the arc of history, and then some that are just weird things that we probably memory hold. In terms of the arc of history, agencies monitor Iraqis in the U.S. for terror threat. We're still trying to do that whole Iraq war thing around this time.
It's interesting because it's like we've got like, you know, every, you know, we do this every week. So we are actually going through a week by week process of hearing headlines about the ramp up to the Iraq war. And I'm at the point now where I'm like, maybe I'm feeling like every other American was feeling, where I'm like, oh my God, just get on with it. Do the war.
Yeah. I think that was what their strategy was just exhaustion. Like, all right, you've been talking about it for 8 straight months. Could you just invade already and leave us alone?
I know. You keep promising to do it. Jesus Christ.
The Bush administration has begun to monitor Iraqis in the United States in an effort to identify potential domestic terrorist threats posed by sympathizers of the Baghdad regime, senior government officials said. The previously undisclosed intelligence program involves tracking thousands of Iraqi citizens and Iraqi Americans with dual citizenship who are attending American universities or working at private corporations and who might pose a risk in the event of a United States-led war against Iraq. You know, holy just shit. In case that happens.
I don't even remember this. This is like they were going to do like fucking internment camps or what?
I think it's just an early foreshadowing of the Patriot Act where they're like, we might be doing some stuff right now, but don't worry about it.
We might listen to your phone calls a little bit, you know, get a RICO case on some people trying to do prayers. No big deal.
This was such a fuck time. Having all these flashbacks. And I was like only in high school.
Yeah.
During this era. I know you were too, Matt.
Yeah.
I just like now I'm just having all these memories of like, this is so fuck. And of course, you know, being a dipshit, dumbass high school student, even me knowing like this is a lie. This is a bad idea. Right. This is, why are we doing this?
Seems fake, but okay. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. That's, I remember just feeling like they are probably lying to us because it feels like they're lying to us and because everything they say sounds like a lie. But what if that one chance in a million that it's not a lie? And
how they get you.
Do I want to be responsible for the mushroom cloud?
Nope.
You know?
Sure don't. Speaking of weird ass time. Uh-huh. I got a nice sign of the times. This is was the second most popular article on the New York Post that day. Religious-based mutual funds unblessed.
Okay.
Americans rediscovered religion after the terrorist attacks in New York and Washington last fall, attending services in greater numbers and sending religious-themed books to the top of the bestseller list.
Oh, boy.
But perhaps the most interesting way that religion entered the life of ordinary Americans was its intersection with another American obsession, the stock market.
Hey, I was just talking about stocks.
Yeah.
Well, listen
up, Matt.
It's
still an obsession. Yeah, this is about me.
Mutual funds that use religious principles to develop their investment focus certainly already existed, but in the past year, the concept has exploded. New funds, as well as already established religious-themed mutual funds, are gathering assets like mad.
What does this mean?
Like just what?
Yeah,
like I'm buying stock in Jesus Christ.
Yeah, right. It's this fucking like you get a little bit of this prophet, you get a little bit of you get all of the apostles. I got stock in Matthew personally, but
I think this could have been the start of like prosperity doctrine type shit. Many people are looking to invest in harmony with their spiritual beliefs, said William Van Alen, chairman of Noah Funds.
Yes. Oh, yes. The grift is strong. I love it.
We are determined to show.
We got two of every stock. That's how we do mutual funds.
The thing about 9/11 era is this was the ultimate era if you wanted to be a grifter. The grift was so easy. Like you could just, all you had to do was slap an American flag on something.
On anything. Yeah.
On anything. And you could sell it in this era.
Yeah, very easily. Like, honestly, we look at the times we live in now and we go like, man, this is so crazy. Everyone's just so openly grifting. And it's like, if you lived through the 9/11 era, it was wild. You couldn't believe the amount of things people were getting away with just because they invoked either Jesus or the American flag. And you were like, I feel like people are willfully falling for this shit. And now I'm just like, of course they believe QAnon is stopping the pedophile cabal. Of
Completely
course.
Natural progression.
Yeah. And there was an interview today with, I think, George W. Bush that came out where he was just like, he was saying like, it disgusted me watching all those people, you know, take over the Capitol and whatnot. And I was just like, motherfucker, you destroyed Iraq.
Yeah, you did that. You did that with planes and stuff.
You did that with fucking planes. If you think that's bad, holy shit. You should see the damage you have wrought.
We are determined to show that you do not have to sacrifice performance when investing with biblically based mutual funds. Incredible sentence. The assets in all religious themed funds are up 191% in the past 10 years. The reason, however, is a bit of a mystery since performance has been anything but heavenly.
I mean, honestly, this is like, this is this era's like Dogecoin. Like, right. These people,
yeah,
they're buying religious crypto.
Uh huh. Pretty much. It's yeah. Dogecoin.
Yeah, Dogecoin. Sure.
There we go.
It's Dogecoin.
We got there.
Yeah, it was there.
You know, another one that you probably forgot about was how popular the Osbournes was in 2002. From the Post, Kelly says, "Shut up." Kelly Osbourne claims
Can she do that? Wow.
Kelly Osbourne claims she doesn't care about how well her debut album Shut Up sells when it's released next week, but she does actually sound like a demon possessed, albeit a very nice, fashionable demon. Sure.
Right.
Maybe she just stretched the metaphor.
Record career.
Yeah, I do remember, like, she had like a single come out, and
she did a cover of Papa Don't Preach.
Yes, that's right.
Remember Jack Osbourne? Remember when he was a guy?
Is he dead?
Yeah. I don't know.
You just never hear about.
He's like I don't know. Did he get canceled, or did he just
He did not get canceled. I think he's just living a quiet life.
Good for him.
I don't know, but maybe didn't he have like a travel show with his dad, now that I think about it?
I thought he got into fitness at some point, and he was like into martial arts and stuff, which I respect as a martial artist.
Oh, yeah, no. Vince is a martial artist, and he respects other martial artists.
That's right. It's a mutual respect thing that you guys probably wouldn't understand. But
no, I super don't.
Yeah, I'm bowing towards my computer just thinking about him. I just had so much fun doing it, writing the songs, recording them, and seeing how they ended up, she says. I'd get crazy. They'd tell me, track 7 is coming in today. I'd freak out until I got to the house, and then I'd run up to the bedroom and lock the door and listen to it about 20 times before I let anyone else hear it.
Oh, well, that's kind of sweet.
Sure.
Good for her.
I mean, it's kind of funny because she's like, oh, we finished your song. And then do you want to hear it? Oh, sure.
Yeah. It's good. Yeah. Imagine having that level of privilege where you just sort of like, you show up one day in the studio and you sing probably poorly. And then you come back and you listen to the song that a bunch of people made for you. I love that, though. That's like at the mall when you would go to the mall and they would make a music video for you.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you know, that's how... Isn't that how that song Friday?
Yeah, it's Friday.
Her parents paid for that. They paid for the whole like studio and the music video.
Yeah, same thing with Kelly. Her parents paid for that. She's the Rebecca Black of her time. But I don't know.
She's Rebecca Black Sabbath.
Very good. Very good, Vince. You're getting better at
it. I mean,
this.
It was right there. I just had to pick it up and throw it in the toilet.
I didn't even see it.
Yeah, well.
You got... Yeah,
gotta have the right kind of eyes. Top movies in the country: Harry Potter and the Chamber of Secrets was the number one movie. Anyone want to guess which number in the Harry Potter series that was?
2.
Is that 2?
That's 2. Wow, you guys both got it.
I got that right.
Yeah, you got it right.
I've never seen Harry Potter.
I saw the first one.
And the first one was kind of good.
It's delightful.
And then the rest of them are all so fucking dull that I don't know how anyone sat through more than 30 minutes of them.
Yeah, I was not a fan of any of the other ones, but that first one was great, despite the fact that the goblins who work in the bank were very much an anti-Semitic stereotype.
Sure. We got really high for that one. We took some edibles, and then during like the sorting hat scene where the hat just starts telling people what cast they belong to. Me and Brett looked at each other like, holy shit, dude, the hat's talking. That was good. That was good.
That's amazing.
And then we thought the other ones would hold up, and they didn't.
No.
Other two movies, 8 Mile and Santa Claus 2 were holdovers. Songs are same as the last couple weeks. Lose Yourself by Eminem. Mom Spaghetti and the top rock song was still You Know You're Right by famous heroin user Kurt Cobain and Nirvana.
He was a former heroin user, and that's a great segue into us talking about The Sopranos. So first, this is once again the Strong and Silent type episode, and the synopsis is essentially this is Chris's intervention episode. It's very... you know, recovery themed, heroin themed, and that's why I have a Bada B story. But first, I just want to say, Vince, first of all, you and Brent, producer Brent, gave me the idea for this Bada B story.
Yeah, yeah.
And I want to point out that the last time I did a Bada B story with a song, I sped it up because it was too long. And I was like, I have to speed it up. And you just shat all over it. You shat.
Well,
you shat
we didn't know what to do. We'd never heard it, it was sped up before.
It was so very high-pitched.
It was a little jarring. We didn't know. It was like, is that Matt or is that like a dolphin who made a song?
Well, so because of that, this one is not sped up and it's a little bit long. So just
look, no one who listens to this podcast complains about the length of your musical parodies that I know.
I don't know, but in my head they do. So ladies and gentlemen, I would like to present to you the Bada B story.
Can I give Brent a shout out for giving you the melody idea here?
Oh yeah. 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 Absolutely.
Cause I suggested Drain You by Nirvana, which is another song that I associate with heroin, but Brent had a better idea, and I think we all agreed. So
we all agreed. Brent, killer idea.
Sweet, thanks.
Strap in, folks.
This is one of those songs that I think I learned when I first started playing guitar that I will never forget the intro to as long as I live because of that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I think this is our generation's Stairway to Heaven.
It is.
Absolutely. 100%.
Sometimes I feel like I sat on my wife's dog. Sometimes I feel like it crawled there for warmth. At least I have Eddie. My junkie friend loves me. Oh, boxers I am. Together we're high.
This is gonna be so long.
I open the door and I see my Carmela. I make her some cafe and ignore her son. I have no girlfriend. I need communication. I wanna kiss her, but she my boss wife.
Oh, it's a red and a hot chili pepper.
And I don't ever wanna see that painting again. I miss my horsey pie, oh my, more than my human friends. And I don't ever wanna see that horse burned again, repainted so that Anthony looks like Napoleon. Yeah, oh yeah, yeah. Oh, only looks like Napoleon. Why would Paul?
It's just gonna keep going. I'm so sorry.
I mean, he's Italian. I guess it kind of makes sense. It kind of makes sense.
Christopher did some drugs. Sopranos intervention.
You're doing Third Eye Blind again.
Yeah, I can't help it.
And Ralphie's still missing. Carmela changes her.
All right. Yeah.
Wait a minute. Is that you singing, Matt?
Yeah, that was me.
Oh my.
What did you think?
I thought you got like a friend to do it. You sound like Anthony Kiedis a lot, like in the first. Like that was a very good impression.
Thank you. I honestly, I'm just going to say this song was surprisingly in my range and I listened to it after I recorded it and I was like, I'm pretty good at singing. Like this was,
you nailed it.
I got
it's a me, Antonio Aquiles.
No, I was very surprised because usually You know, with these songs, I gotta go a few octaves down. I find a way to do that. But with this, I was like, hey, Anthony Kiedis, me, we got the same. Yeah. Anyways, thank you. That was
you could have a tribute band.
Dude, someday.
After quarantine is over. You should think about that.
I should. It would be nice to, you know, I mean, I already got a tribute podcast.
Right.
I feel like having a tribute band also makes sense. But yeah, those about to be stories. That covers all of the storylines that you're going to hear in this episode. I mean, just so much happens. But this is the episode where Chrissy finally is the straw that breaks the camel's back. You know, and he gets
or the dog's
out.
Back.
Well, or the dog's neck.
The great thing about this episode is that I feel like in any other HBO prestige drama, you know, this heroine episode would be like the lead in to like a very dramatic, like very special episode. And yes. I mean, and in some ways it is, but like they refused to do this in any way but a very Sopranos version of an intervention. And I remembered that intervention and it just overshadowed everything else in the episode, and it still does, and it's only because it's so fantastic.
Yeah. I was just going to say that I'm glad they didn't. I mean, obviously, I wouldn't imagine the Sopranos would go in a schmaltzy, like overly dramatic way to handle this, but I think it actually represented like late stage drug addiction very well, and just the banality of it.
Yes.
And how it's 100%. Just so lame.
Yes. Yes. That's my favorite thing that they do with drug addiction in this show is they don't romanticize it at all. They show exactly how lame it is to be a junkie. Like it's not fucking like him, like Chrissy getting beaten up by some Puerto Ricans, you know, and getting his watch stolen. Like that's almost more romantic than they usually do it.
Right.
For the most part, it truly is.
But
sitting,
there's no
watching TV.
There's no like cool montage where like the heroin bubbles on the spoon, and then and then like there's a close up on the syringe, and then his pupil pins out when he's like every other thing would have done it that way. Because I don't know, I feel like directors love to shoot drug scenes because it's usually something that they haven't done. So it's like, oh, we've seen this. This is cool. Let's really stylize this. And The Sopranos is just like, nah, he's going to shoot up and sit on the dog like a fucking Three Stooges bit.
Yeah. It feels like it is like most drug scenes in movies and whatnot are directed by current active drug addicts who this is the cool thing that they see in their head when they're doing drugs. Like even the pain is cool. You know, it's like the suffering, you know, like, you know, pulling out a fucking sink from a bathroom, just like looking in the mirror going, what am I, you know, all that shit. But like The Sopranos feels like it was directed and written by someone in recovery who's like, no,
or someone having to deal with a high person where they're just ugh, this fucking bullshit again.
They're just the worst. And you don't realize that as an addict, you don't realize until like years later sometimes just how much of an asshole you were, and how annoying you were,
and repetitive, just how repetitive your bullshit is.
Totally. Like, and just how much everyone had to put up with you for however many years. And you're just like so embarrassed. Like,
so it's embarrassed.
The ultimate cringe. You haven't experienced cringe.
Yes.
Until you've been a junkie and then recovered.
Yeah.
And I speak from personal experience, because looking back, it's like, yes, there were moments where maybe I thought things were glamorous, or I wanted to make them glamorous. But a majority, 95% of my moments were absolutely humiliating and embarrassing.
Completely.
Well, every junkie memoir is always like the same bullshit origin story where they're like, yeah, I just had this like increased capacity for feeling the pain of being alive in the world. And that's why I had to deaden myself with drugs. And it's just like, and you read them and
I care too much.
Yeah.
Or, you know,
like they all have something where they're super special. Like Kurt Cobain, I remember like half the things about Kurt Cobain were about like, yeah, he had this like rare digestive thing where he just had this like this unexplained stomach pain that he had to dull with drugs.
And right. He like, had an ulcer that he had to. Right. And it's like, listen, I'm not saying that heroin wouldn't help an ulcer. Of course
but,
it would.
But that's what a heroin junkie would yeah. use to treat an ulcer and yes. not whatever the fuck you actually are supposed to take.
Yeah,
and that's what like they would tell you about why they're yeah. doing drugs more than anything else. It's always yeah, like, oh, I'm doing it because I have this pain that no one else has ever experienced before.
And that's right. the thing is, it's like, it's not meant to put down people who are currently, you know, going through pain and, you know, using alcohol or drugs to dull it or to numb it out. It makes sense. It's not to put that down, but it's not special. It's right. not something like your pain isn't more special or harder than most, like on average, you're usually dealing with an average level of pain that is part of like the human experience.
And
it's
mostly right. part of the cycle of like withdrawal that you created by doing the drugs.
That's so true. I can't say how much wreckage has just come from me being in that in-between moment without drugs and then causing drama in that moment and just being like, man, it's just the drugs. And it's like, no, it's the withdrawal. It's being without drugs that would oh my God. I like, yeah, you're right, Rachel. There's no level. You don't know cringe until you recover from being a drug addict and look back at all the times you just, you know, called your friends up at 2 a.m. crying and not telling them why.
Or conversely, call your friends up at 2 a.m. when you're mm-hmm. tweaked out of your mind and be like, hey, you want to talk right now?
Or just like coming out as bisexual and not being bisexual, you know, just like, I'm pretty sure I'm bisexual. And people are like, okay, I don't know why you're sure. freaking out right now. But yeah, it's wonderful. The amount of dullness and, the mundaneness of Chrissy's drug addiction. And in this episode is the first time that we see, from what I can remember, it's the first time we see an actual like casualty, from his addiction beyond like kind of the abusive stuff he's done with aid. We open it with him, killing Cosette.
Mm, poor little Cosette.
By sitting on her neck
yeah.
and just breaking it. And it's like one of those things where I'm like, it's a fear that I have with my cat a lot and I'm sober, but it's a fear that I have with my cat. And I'm just kind of the opinion that I think that dog would move, right?
I mean, one would hope.
Or make a noise.
I mean, it didn't make a noise right after. It went like, and then it died. But they also took its like vocal cords out because it was too yappy. So
yeah.
Who knows?
Oh, yeah. That seems wrong.
Yeah.
Yeah,
to do that. Up. You know, maybe Adriana should take a look at that.
Yeah, yeah.
But I mean, he immediately goes into excuse mode and all of his excuses are just so beautifully lame.
Oh yeah, I have a clip of the of Cosette being dead.
Where's the dog?
You shut the TV.
Oh my God, Cosette.
I like you shut the TV because it's like it's such a weird malapropism that people do all the time. Yeah.
What?
Christopher, she's not breathing. Her neck feels broken.
The fuck.
Oh my God, she's dead.
I fell asleep.
What?
She must have crawled under there for warmth.
Are you fucking crazy? You fucking killed her.
I didn't kill her. I must have sat on her.
Oh, jeez.
I didn't. Do you think I've gone too far? I didn't. Guilty as charged.
I mean, yeah, it must have crawled under there for warmth. It was pretty good. And then he also blames her. And he says, how many times I tell you to keep her off the furniture?
Yeah, I know. Right. He immediately goes into victim blame. And he also just said she must have crawled under there for warmth as an excuse.
Like they're living out in the fucking in nature and the dog was trying to get shelter from the elements in his ass.
It's so funny because, like, in that moment, he's thinking to himself, like, oh, poor thing. Too bad, just, you know, death randomly happens this way. And it's like, no, motherfucker. Like, there's nothing romantic about this. You actually sat on its neck and broke it.
Right. It's a horrific way to have your pet die. It's so traumatic. And they did, this was so subtle in just the way that they portrayed, like, the alcoholic getting mad at the person who has a right to be mad at them.
Yes.
And pushing it on them, like, you know, keep Cosette off the furniture.
Right. Yeah. How many times did I tell you to keep Cosette off the furniture on the off chance that I nod out on the dog and break its neck? Just the perfect victim blaming from Christopher. And yeah, you know, it just kind of starts this spiral towards, you know, what's eventually going to happen with Chris in this episode. But before we get to more of that, the other storylines that are happening, we've got Carm and Furio having the continuation of their lovely
She's
relationship.
She's got a new haircut to try and impress Furio, and she gets a hairstyle that I would describe as a modified "Can I speak to the manager?" haircut. You know, she's got
a modified Karen.
Yeah. She's got, anytime you see like an angle that's like more than 45 degrees from the neck up to the crown of the head, that's I think that's what you're dealing with there.
And yeah,
and Tony, being the great husband that he is, he notices her hair, which is actually like a good husband move. But then his first question is, what the hell did you do to your hair?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
The wrong thing to say, which only cements further that he is not the sensitive flower.
No.
That
no.
Furio is
100%, and it's like like the fact that he wanted to be informed. I thought we were going to talk before you change your hair. It's like, that's a level of control that I both think is moderately abusive, but I also am like, well, if you have that understanding in a relationship, I guess. I mean, if you're someone who's really into your wife's hair and you just desperately don't want it changed, you know, maybe who am I to judge? But
I think that was a moment of how dare you possibly make yourself less fuckable to me.
Even though I'm fucking all these other chicks on the side all the time.
Not going to go over super well.
I mean, Carm, in a way, is sort of his trophy wife. I mean, in multiple ways. And I think that's kind of a theme throughout the episode. Tony, the episode is called The Strong Silent Type, you know, which is not his whole thing about Gary Cooper and what happened to men being men and whatnot. Well, this episode contains three strong silent types and two weak whiny types. And I feel like both of the weak whiny types, that's my alternate title for this episode, is the weak whiny type. And it's Tony and Christopher are both weak whiny types. And you've got Svetlana, Furio, and Carmela are, to me, the actual strong silent types in there. You know, like, Furio and Carmela are both desperately in love, but they are doing everything they can to continue that love being unrequited. You know, they're not saying the thing that they want to say to each other. And a lot of that is because they have kind of the strength of character to know that, and also they're smart enough to know it's a terrible, terrible idea.
Right. I think part of it, remember in Seinfeld when Elaine and the other, and one of her boyfriends both think the other one is like Hispanic or something. And so they like convince themselves that they're in a interracial relationship and that it's really cool because of that. And they realize, and then they realize like they don't actually like each other. I think that's like, this is like a very, like they're, both Carmela and Furio have convinced themselves that they're in this like tragic star-crossed relationship that can never be. And they're both really into the drama and the melodrama of that, and more so than each other, really.
I always thought it was tragic that Carmela never fucked Furio.
Me
and she
too.
Never fucked that priest.
Yeah.
Because, yeah. I mean, she was just loyal to Tony till the end.
Well, like, she tried to fuck the priest, but then he like came in his pants and she was pissed.
Oh, right.
Yeah. But she didn't really. But she didn't really try to fuck the priest. Like she didn't. She never went there. Like,
well, she like, basically she, like said, "Hey, I'm ready. You better make a move." And then he kind of didn't, and then she lost respect.
She put herself in the position. But the question is, would Carmella ever go through with it? And I am kind of a firm no on that. I think at the end of the day, you know, Carmella tried to, in that episode specifically, tried to tell the priest that he has this weird thing about like flirting and unrequited love and like using the fact that he can't have sex with someone as like kind of an emotionally manipulative tool. And I think that's total projection. I think that Carmella also does the thing where she falls in love with people that she can't have.
Yeah. I think she wanted him to make a move, but yeah, she probably would have, you know, she probably would have like pushed him off after he got the tip in, and then it would, you know,
That's a very specific moment. We can't do this anymore. But Furio is still desperately in love with Carmella, but he still is doing his best to not push that boundary. And he starts off by once again not coming inside. And I have a clip of that.
Come in, come in. He's getting dressed.
I wait in the car.
Oh, well, welcome back.
I bring presents.
Really? That is so sweet.
Also, for the grown-ups, I bring some of my uncle's wine, but it's come later.
I just made some coffee, you sure?
Thank you, but I wait in the car.
Yeah, Furio brought back his magic sex wine from Italy that makes everybody want to screw each other.
Yeah, no, and refused to give it to her because, you know, he has it. He has the wine, but he's thinking twice about actually giving her a present.
She can't drink of the magic of sex wine. Who knows what'll happen?
He has restraint where Tony has none.
Right. None.
Because Tony just, I mean, Tony will fuck anyone that's next to him, literally sitting on a couch next to him.
I mean, this whole episode is like in the aftermath of him killing Ralph in like the absolute worst moment that he could have killed Ralph in.
Right. And now he's dealing with that fallout. And Carmella, I mean, she also obviously has restraint and she has like a code of ethics that she sticks to.
Yeah. They are
like, the principle of it.
They're the strong silent type, and it's so funny that like that is the one thing that Tony aspires to be. He wishes he was Furio, you know, and he wishes he was Svetlana even, because you know both Tony and Chrissy always succumb to whatever the temptation is. Whatever the temptation is, they fucking go for it, and it's like they latch on to stronger people. Even though they both consider themselves to be, they consider themselves to be the strong silent type, but they're fucking not. So the Svetlana kind of storyline in this episode is interesting too, because this is the first episode where, and I don't know if it's the way they shot it or whatnot, where I was like, oh yeah, Svetlana is super cute.
Also, low key, one of the best actors on this show.
Really good.
I don't think she ever got her due for how good, like everything about this character is so perfect and encompasses like so many layers to this character. Like at first she's just sort of like the gruff Russian who doesn't put up with any of Janice's bullshit.
Yeah. One-legged Russian smoking a cigarette while fucking like being on crutches and you're just like, God, she's a badass.
Which is perfect. But then there's more to her and those, all the other layers are great too.
Yeah. She's just a magnificent character. She's super funny. The actress is incredibly talented and gorgeous. And it's, and so you watch the scene where Tony hooks up with her and you're kind of like, you know, at first, like the thought is like, she's, you know, you can minimize her as being the one-legged nurse or whatever, but then you get to know her in the, you know, throughout the series and you're like, no, she's like super hot. And I totally get it. Like 100%. And, I do love too, after they hook up, Tony is doing his standard issue. Hey, you know, maybe see you again sometime. I don't know. Like, I'm kind of busy right now. But, you know, maybe next Thursday or whatever. And she's like, no, this is not a good idea. No.
He can't stand that because the girls, they always want to see him a second time.
Well, yeah, even worse, like, he expects her to be, like, to feel like he was generous to share the dick with a one-legged chick. Like, he thinks she should be grateful as a cripple. And when she's not, he can't figure it out.
Yeah, he's like legit offended. He's just like, he just at one point goes, you didn't like it?
Like, a disabled broad. Yeah. I can't believe she wouldn't be grateful that I banged her out on my uncle's stinky couch.
Yeah. I don't mean to be ableist over here. But you're lucky to have me, all right? Yeah. You only got one leg. I got two. But yeah, it is, you know, she totally rejects him and gives him the kind of like, you know, don't call me, I'll call you type thing, which is maybe the most badass thing she's done on the show. There's just like, she's the coolest.
There's also a very good little Italian-American moment in there with Junior and the wine. Because, like, you know, Junior is, like, the first generation, so you'd expect him to... I feel like Tony's generation would expect Junior's generation to really sort of appreciate, like, Italian food and culture and stuff. And Junior immediately, like, proves himself to be, like, a wine philistine where he takes a sip of the wine and he's like, ah, just think of people's feet.
Yeah, yeah. It tastes like people's feet. Yeah.
That's the thing I loved, always loved about the... when we were first introduced to Furio and they were in Italy, was the juxtaposition of the Italian Americans and the Italian Italians.
Yeah,
in Italy.
The actual
and
Italians.
Just how like, oh, you guys all think you're so Italian, but you're just a bunch of trash people from Jersey.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Like you could, I mean, like just going back to that when they were in Italy, it's like I feel like even the guys, like they all knew it. They're like, oh, we are so not on the level.
Yeah. I mean, these guys, they've spent their whole lives being sort of feeling superior to like wasps and like that they're so much more
cultured.
Yeah. And then they go to Italy and they're like, ooh, this is way too ethnic for me. This is scary.
Right. Yeah. They're like the squid ink pasta that Paulie has. And he's just like, I don't want this.
wants macaroni.
He wants. Yeah, exactly. Like these guys are American New Jersey trash people. Right. And it is kind of like, I mean, I think there is a fetishization of ethnicities other than their own, European ethnicities, like even, you know, with the Svetlana scene, you know, Tony is ascribing all of this, you know, strength of character and like strength to deal with pain to like, you know, you're a Russian immigrant. You came, you know, from nothing. And you come here and you make a life for yourself. You got one leg, you know. You got a weird eye, you know.
Over here, all off balance.
Yeah, you smell weird, you know. I call you names. They all on the show, they love the European idea.
Well, she's all the immigrant myths that she embodies, all the immigrant myths that Tony's been trying to convince AJ that they represent, and then he sees Svetlana, and so she is that to him.
Yeah, and
I mean, I went to Russia when I was 18 because my grandma's Russian, and so we went together, and you know, I have like, I'm like very proud of my Russian heritage, and I went there, I'm like, oh, I'm just a trashy American.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
So like, I'm just a trashy American.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think America, and I don't know if this is probably true of other countries as well. But I do feel like in America, with, I think white people, especially, there is kind of like, we like to attach some genealogical traits to whatever ethnic heritage, our like great great grandfather or grandfather or mother or father. Like, oh, there's something special that we're mixing into this melting pot and whatnot.
Right.
Having no ties to the culture outside of maybe your own home at most.
Exactly. Exactly.
And then kind of being like, oh shit, this is, you know, going to that country and being like, oh, this is weird.
This is weird and scary to me.
And also, the people who live here don't seem super into it. Like, oh,
yeah. Right. And they don't consider me a Russian the way I consider myself. Like, oh, what's your heritage? Like, oh, I'm Russian on my mom's side and I'm this and that on my dad's side. Like,
yeah, right.
You know, and like the cultural stuff that's in my home, like in a, you know, Eastern European Jewish household is like very different than it was going over there and hanging out with people there.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. It's it's what we like to do as Americans. We like to mythologize about other places, visit them, and then complain about how they weren't living up to the standards that you'd hoped for.
I mean, everybody kind of does that. It's just like,
oh, I do it all the time.
Well, and when you live in a city, and you know, and you have friends that come and visit you, they want to go to like whatever the main tourist attractions of that city are, and like nine times out of ten you haven't been there yourself because it's always like, oh yeah, I'll go to Alcatraz eventually, and you don't because it's just there and it's not a thing that you do feel the need to do.
You don't feel the need to do it. And it's half of it is because it's there. The other half is because when you think about doing that thing, it always clashes against you live there and it's real life and you have other shit to do.
Yeah.
You're not spending 7 days in the Bay Area and like going, I have to see Alcatraz. You're like, I don't know. I got a job here. I got a girlfriend. I got a fucking mortgage. Like, there's other shit to do.
Oh, look, I went to Alcatraz once and it was on a field trip when I was like 8.
Yeah.
I grew up in San Francisco. So it's like, I went there once.
Yeah.
I'm not going to go there again.
Yeah.
If you're visiting San Francisco and you ask me like where to go, stay away from Fisherman's Wharf. Like, for the love of God, just like please do something else.
Yeah.
Except for Scummas. They got good crab. Go get that crab there.
Yeah. Get,
yeah, sure.
You can get some, seafood.
Yeah. Get some seafood, but like mostly avoid Fisherman's Wharf. Yeah.
My favorite joke from like a open mic comic was, growing up, my dad used to work at the wharf. Every night he'd come home smelling of t-shirts.
It's pretty good. That's not a great joke, but you know.
It's a pretty good joke.
It's cute.
Yeah.
It's cute.
It's cute. I like it.
Our bodies come in different shapes and sizes, so doesn't it make sense that our weight loss plans should too? That's the beauty of Noom. They build a personal plan that factors in dietary restrictions, medical issues, and other personal needs so your plan works for you. Noom doesn't restrict or shame when you want to treat yourself. Their flexible program focuses on progress instead of perfection. You don't have to give up carbs or anything. And with their daily lessons, you can learn something new about your food choices every day. After just a few days of using the app, I learned how to recognize cues for overeating and how to choose the right foods to feel full. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's Noom.com. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Tony comes into the Bing. They're still looking for Ralph. And while he's on the phone trying to call Ralph, pretending like he's not dead, a package comes for him. And and it's the painting is finished. It's Pai Oh My and him with Ralphie cropped out, which is amazing. And he immediately throws a fit. He like runs out of the room basically in the middle of a pool game and decides to call Syl and give him his orders from the phone. Meanwhile, later we see Benny and Little Polly?
Yeah. In which scene?
It's the scene when they're trying to burn the painting afterwards.
Yeah.
It's Vinny Benny, Delpino from Doogie Howser.
From Doogie Howser. But it's for The Sopranos' sake, it's Benny and Little Polly. They're trying to burn it, and Polly sees this and freaks out because he's like, whoa. This
is a nice painting.
He says, this is a nice
classy
painting.
Piece like this, horse with the trees.
And like, part of it is like he sees some art there, you know, where he's just like, this is worth something. But the other part of it is like, he is just like, I'm a classy guy.
Right. Yeah. I could have art in my house.
I could have an art inside of my house. I love art, especially classy art. And he decides to
put this one next to the clowns and the Velvet Elvis. And
the Velvet Elvis.
Oh, what are you doing?
What? Still said torchy.
Classy piece like this, horse with the trees, wooden frame, 25 to 30 G's at a minimum.
I think it was Tony said he wanted it burnt, poorly, specifically.
Put it in my car.
25 to 30 G's?
Horse with the trees, wooden frame? I love that line.
Like, there's no way 25 to 30 G's for that painting. Like, he's no. Yeah. He's insane. He has no idea
Tony
what
paid
art...
$6,000 to commission it.
Yeah, to get it painted.
Yeah.
But yeah, he, and you know, he sees a classy piece of art. He wants to save it, but he didn't count on the fact that having your boss's fucking weird ass face looking at you in your own home is going to freak you out a bit.
Also, here's the thing. I mean, if Tony went to prison and was like all over the news as this famous mob boss, and you had a painting of him with this horse that he killed in an insurance scam, I feel like that painting would actually be worth something.
That's true. That's true.
You
like
make
the
a good
only
point.
Like if that was the reason he went down, you would have the only surviving painting of this horse that's dead now, who took down a mob boss.
Yeah, I'm sure that's how he thought it through in that sense, in terms of appraising it in that very moment.
Yes, sure.
Not that it was classy.
No, not at all.
Long term.
Yeah, he was thinking long term investment. You know, he wanted to have, you know, some of his assets are liquid and some of them are horse paintings, and that's right. Fine. But yeah, he sees it staring at him and he realizes, oh, this is not good. So he goes to a... I don't know. He has a guy who touches up paintings.
An Indian man.
Yeah, which of course I love. I love that he's got a guy. And he asks to have it repainted like a revolutionary general. And I have a clip of that.
How much to paint a different suit on him? Change his face a little.
Pardon me?
Why throw it away? A stronger chin, maybe. I was thinking like those paintings you see in the courthouse. Something classy, you know, like... a Revolutionary War general, Napoleon and his horse, that kind of thing.
He's rather portly to be Napoleon.
Not Napoleon exactly.
Listen, bro, I know Napoleon. Yeah. Your friend, no Napoleon.
Yes, he is a fat Napoleon, not going to work.
Napoleon, great man. This?
The painting, once it gets rendered to look like this war general, it looks even more deranged.
Yeah.
After the fact, like, to me that would be even creepier having that.
Oh, looks completely insane.
I love that painting, so good. There's just like a random like historically inaccurate Revolutionary War general next to a horse.
It still looks exactly like Tony.
Yeah.
He should have put a beard on him or something.
He didn't change his face one iota.
Wouldn't be accurate. Like in the Revolutionary War, there was no facial hair.
They didn't have beards.
Yeah, no.
Yeah. But I love the fact that these, like, you know, make him look like, you know, someone classy like Napoleon. You know, I want it to look like the classy paintings they have in the courthouse. And it's like, I don't know. Like, your frame of reference is so mafia that, like, if I were a painter and you told me all that, I'm like, just context clues alone, I know you've murdered people.
Absolutely. And he's never been in an art museum. He's never stepped foot in one before.
No. He's always found them a bit queer for his taste.
Absolutely.
And so just him deciding on the Napoleon thing, I thought, to tie it back to like their obsession with people of European ancestry, like, to me, I was just like, this is just his, this whole weird Sopranos European fetish where he's just like, oh yeah, it's something classy, you know, like not from here at all, you know, like something foreign and weird, like Napoleon or horses, you know? So it's kind of, it's a lovely Pauly moment. And, I appreciate anytime Pauly makes, a few, you know, a multiple scene appearance and has his own storyline in the Sopranos.
Yeah.
Me too.
But you know, obviously, like, the centerpiece scene in all of this is the intervention.
Yes. So to get there, excuse me. To get there, we gotta say what happens you know, with Chris's storyline. So we start out, obviously, he breaks Cosette's neck. And then this kind of sends Adriana down a spiral. You know, she's trying very desperately not to snitch. You know, she knows she's caught up with the FBI, but she's not telling anything. And you can tell that she's like being very like cagey with them. And this is the first time I think we see her do some legit snitching. And it's mostly about how her boyfriend, fiance, just killed her dog and is a drug addict.
He's fucking stoned on H all the time, okay?
You know, we put you guys on the mailing list for Hazelden.
That rehab shit. Is where all those brochures are coming from? From you?
Convince him he needs help, that he should be in rehab.
No. Look at you with that little face.
I like that they're just listening to some Lilith Fair ass music.
Totally.
But also, this part of the story, I don't know if I can buy that the FBI is jeopardizing their sting to send Christopher fucking rehab brochures. Like, if they thought they had a weak link heroin addict in the mafia, they would just try and catch that guy with drugs on him and turn him like they would, like they did with Adriano. Like, why would...
Right.
I don't know. I don't know what that would accomplish to send rehab brochures to their house.
I wasn't sure either. But I kind of, I just went with it because I assumed that, like, you know, we all know, like, the FBI, they really care about people.
Sure. I mean, it clearly was like a means to an end to have for Adriana and Chris to have this sort of confrontation.
Yeah, maybe it was for them there to be a rift and her not wanting to protect him anymore because he beat the shit out of her when she confronted him about his problem.
And that would be a crazy long con if that was their entire thing, was so that he would be like, where are all these brochures coming from? It must be you. I'm going to beat you up. Like, damn, that is... I mean, I wouldn't put it past the FBI.
No, I think they're it's more like for a, doing when I say means to an end, I mean more for like the showrunners than...
figured. Yeah.
But yeah, I mean... at this point, Adriana's got to wonder, like, this is the life that I'm going to go to jail to protect, this lifestyle?
Yeah, seems not worth it. And and it keeps getting worse. You know, Chris ends up getting robbed by some Puerto Rican fellas. And he reacts to that robbery in a way that I'm like, I got to respect, like, being able to talk back to people who you're buying drugs from who are trying to rob you. Because as someone who has been robbed by drug dealers before, not at gunpoint, but at, like, kind of, like, insinuated gunpoint, where you don't see a gun, but they, you know, are, like...
you don't have to, like, pull that gun out, sir. You can just have the money.
Yeah. Oh, you can take the money. Yeah. I'll give you the money. Yeah, that's fine. But, you know, the way that he's just like, hey, what are you gonna, they're like, what are you going to use this for? And he's like, to fuck your mother or something.
No,
he's
so what are you going to do with this? I'm going to put it in your mother's twat.
Right.
a bold move because it's like, man, you know, you got to give him points for bravery.
They could have just popped him right there and ended it. Like for a statement like that.
Yeah, you'd fit.
Instead, they just beat him down with a xylophone, which was a really good, a really good detail.
So funny. Beating
it's
someone.
It's great because that's a humiliating thing to get beat with. It's like so infantilizing and just. It's humiliating.
Just
it's
making doink and clang sounds while you get your head kicked in.
Just hitting you in the head with a triangle and a fucking tambourine. You got a whole family band there. Put this kazoo up his ass. Make him play the Star Spangled Banner. Like that is it's beautiful. And we get introduced to one of my favorite one-time-only characters, Eddie. Eddie the Junkie, who
poor bastard.
Comes home.
I mean, he was just trying to do Christopher a solid. In exchange for money. Cleaned him up, gave him some drugs, and he wanted to get paid back for the drugs that he shelled out.
Oh,
Eddie is such a perfect example of the kinds of people you just end up hanging out with and becoming friends with completely out of the blue.
Yes.
Because you're high or you're like doing, you know, you're buying drugs somewhere and you meet this person and suddenly like you're in their car.
Yeah.
Or you're at their house or they're at your house and you're at it, like, who the fuck is this?
And he acts like your old friends. It's like, no, it's me, Eddie, you know, from down the park.
But that's the thing is, introducing him to other people is always the most embarrassing thing. Like being next to someone who is essentially he's not your plug, but he knows the good plug. Like he knows the good dealer. So you're like, oh, fuck, I got to hang out with this guy. He knows where all the morphine is. So I got to have this shirtless guy in my car. And like, I can't tell you the amount of times I've had to drive people who I'm just like, oh God, this is, I just don't want to spend a long period of time with this person, you know, to the drug dealer's house. And sometimes they become your friend.
I kicked someone out of, I don't know if my car was moving. I don't remember, but it was, I violently threw someone out of my car once because I had made friends with them, quote unquote, earlier in the night, but by 7 a.m. I was sick of them.
Yes.
And they were driving me fucking nuts and I had hit a wall and I was just trying to score.
Yes.
You know, it's 7 a.m. and this person wouldn't stop talking. And I finally was like, get the fuck out of the car. Get the fuck out of the car. And I just threw them out of my car, my little Volvo. And it was, you know, but those are the types of people I would invite into, you know, my spaces or my car or introduce to whoever was still hanging around with me at that time.
I can't imagine all the people that you were forced to hang out with just in the process of trying to get drugs.
It's the worst.
I moved in with my drug dealer. Like,
oh damn, nice.
So there were people coming in and out all the time. People who I just did not want to see.
Yeah,
you have to hang out with them.
Yeah, it's part of the deal. Yeah, it really is. I mean, it's just like for me. It's like it's an argument for legalization because it's like sometimes you just want to go to the store and buy the drugs.
Yeah,
but it was always like I was always in the position of having a phone number just go dead on me where I was just like, you lose your connection and then you're like, oh, what's the name of that weird guy, Eddie or something? I have his number in my phone. Hey, Eddie, you know, and then you have to call them and you have to talk to them. And then, oh man, oh, I can't even, like, I had this one guy who literally, I drove him and his friend. Randomly, he brought his friend into my car because he was the guy who knew the new drug dealer I needed to meet. And they spent the whole ride fucking just being like, basically telling me like part of this, you know, like introduction process, like to meet this person, like you're going to have to pay us by like giving us drugs too. And I was just like, okay, yeah, I get it. This is a super secret, like fucking whatever. And it just ended up being like just some guy. And we bought the drugs and I was like, here's your fucking, I never want to talk to you again. It was like 2 hours with people. Anyways.
I feel like the dealers are probably like always buddying up to you, and they're like, you know, you're trying to do like a conversation where you guys each share stories about your lives, and their life is way different than yours, but then you realize what your life has sort of become in having to swap stories with that person.
True, true, but it's different because we're not talking just dealers. What we're talking about is addicts who also have the connections.
Right.
So you're like, you make a lot of friends with people who are just other addicts. It's kind of like recovery, but backwards.
It's the cursed version of recovery.
It's the cursed version, yes.
You're hanging out with people who would not normally mix.
Yes.
Whereas in recovery, you're doing the same, but it's in a generally positive
light. In a positive direction. In a healthy way.
You are talking and
connecting with addicts in a healthy way.
But that is the magic of being a drug addict and alcoholic, is you can drop us anywhere in the world and we will find the other addicts.
Yes.
And be like, hey, where can I score?
Yeah.
It's like we have a radar or something.
We do. We have this. It's because we all have the same look on our face, which is like, where is it? It's the same look. Honestly, it's the same look that the T-1000 had most of the movie when he's just looking for John Connor, like that movie. I swear the actor was fucking like, he modeled himself after a junkie who's in complete mission mode, because that's what you look like. You're like, where is it? Anyways, yeah,
that's okay. I mean, I brought it, my poor father, I brought some guy home who I had met in a video store. This is how long ago this was. I was a teenager, and you know, the next thing I know, we're driving through Marin County with a gun in the back seat, and he's running late for his therapy appointment. It was tragic.
Eddie. You know,
but
from
that's
the
what
video
I said
store.
To my dad, because I brought him home so we could like do the drugs that we had got, and this is all happening in the morning. Like it was in the morning, and I don't know how long I'd been awake for, but. You know, I'm like, this is so-and-so, Dad. He's a friend of mine from school. I had never met this guy before until I met him at the video store.
Yeah.
I didn't know this guy.
Yeah, he's cool. Leave us alone. That's a great way to introduce people.
Oh, my God. Baby, what happened?
Got jacked by some spics. Took his ride, his fucking watch, too.
Jesus Christ, the Cartier? Christopher, you're bleeding.
Stop touching it.
Oh my God, baby.
Does she think I could get some money?
What? Who are you?
Eddie. Down the park.
He's good people, Adrian.
I took him home, you know, he's all fucked up, but I'm straightening him out. Here's my $30.
Get the fuck out of here.
What?
Adrian.
Get out of my house.
Don't stick me on this, man.
Get out.
What's the matter with you? The guy's my friend.
That's your friend?
That's your friend, dude. That's Eddie. And
that's Eddie from the park.
Yeah, it's Eddie from the park, from down the park. Everyone knows Eddie. It's old junkie Eddie. What I love to, this is a bit of trivia for this episode. Eddie, I don't know if you noticed, Vince, is wearing the jacket.
Yeah, I didn't notice that until you pointed it out. That's a really good
detail. Jacket?
The jacket from the
jacket.
It was like, the jacket. It was like is Richie Aprile.
Oh, that jacket.
Yeah, Richie Aprile gives Tony the jacket. Tony does not like the jacket, gives it to Carm, who gives it to the maid, who it somehow ends up on Eddie. And
incredible.
A beautiful touch. So it ends up with that scene ends with Aid being beaten and assaulted by Chris for, you know, she shows him brochures of rehab and he gets mad, steals money out of her wallet, hits her, and then leaves. And that's when Adriana tells Tony and Carmela, and they decide, hey, we got to have an intervention. And they end up doing a pre-intervention with this guy. His name is Dominic. What's his last name? One second.
We call him Pork Loin Dominic.
Pork Loin.
He stole all those pork loins.
Yeah.
An ex-con. He's like an ex-mafioso. Is that what he's supposed to be?
Yeah, or
is
he's a low-level mob guy who... He's like the one mob guy that they know who's in recovery, who probably did something, you know, like stole pork loins and went to jail and then got clean in jail.
Yeah, and is the one guy they know. And it's so funny watching them have no regard for anyone in recovery. I almost respect it in a way where I'm just like, you know, they're just regular guys who, you know, who look at a person in recovery and say, you know, you're, if you were a scumbag once, you're a scumbag for life. And I'm like, man, these guys, they hold on to a grudge. I respect that. And I have a clip of the pre-intervention interview.
Good afternoon. For those of you who don't know me, my name is Dominic, and I'm an alcoholic and an addict.
Don't forget, scumbag.
Now, any one of you guys been involved in an intervention before?
Caught our daughter smoking pot once.
I like how he didn't even, like Paulie doesn't even really know this guy, and he's just like, not to mention a piece of shit, am I right? Hey, I came here to help you, but okay, God.
I mean, I can only imagine that he remembers him as the guy who stole the pork loins. I don't know, but he's just looking at him. He's like, he's a piece of shit. Clearly.
But,
not really, no.
No problem. An intervention is a non-judgmental confrontation. A carefrontation, we call it.
Ugh. What if he's high when we try to talk to him?
Then we wait till he's sober. During my first intervention, Stephen Petrano waited 10 hours for me to sober up.
Your first intervention?
In 1997, I suffered a relapse. As in heroin addiction, alcoholics suffer fairly high recidivism rate.
Great. So he's taking advice from a two-time loser.
Fucking so mean.
It's so real, though. This scene is just so grounded in reality because, like, look, drug addicts and alcoholics, like, we are fucking scumbags until we learn not to be scumbags do a lot of work and make a lot of amends and completely fix our lives. And so it's like, this is the reaction we get from people who know us only from our actions before, or as someone who is a quote unquote two-time loser who doesn't know what the recovery process. I love that. I love that they were treating him as such. And I mean, at least in my case, like we were talking before we started recording, like both Matt and I had interventions, like you do call the person who's a friend of the family who is in recovery to be like, what do we do? You know?
Yeah. Yeah. That's the way you do it. I mean, it's like, and I completely agree with you too, that it's like, there is something about showing the very, you know, it's not the show Intervention where people are like crying and whatnot. And this, it's literally people who are mad.
Him.
Someone who, they people don't who know are mad and one guy who's incredibly defensive.
Yeah. And they're also, they look at people who have wronged them and go like, I don't care what your excuse. I don't care if you were high back then and are sober now. When you wrong someone, that it is kind of up to them whether or not they want to consider you a scumbag or not. That's not on you anymore. You can't be like, no, but I'm changed. I'm different and better now. No,
I mean, that's part of the recovery process is knowing that when you do go around eventually and make all of your amends, it's not up to you for the other person to forgive you. If they decide not to forgive you, well, okay. Like,
you gotta move on.
Keep
your side of the street clean and fucking continue making a living amends. But like, are absolutely allowed not to accept that you're not a scumbag anymore. And living with that is a lot of fun as an addict, because you're just like, hey, you know what? Some people out there are like, oh yeah, I know that guy. He's a piece of shit. He's the guy who's crashed my car.
I love that they had Adriana start, because, you know, theoretically, like, she'd be the most sympathetic and most into this process, because she's going to benefit the most from it.
Yes.
And she immediately does like the worst thing that she could possibly do, which is like, she basically just calls him, instead of pointing out all the awful things that he does when he's high, she's like, you don't fuck me anymore and you're not a man.
You don't function as a man.
Yeah.
And just so fucked
in front of all his friends,
in front of all the guys, like, to emasculate him like that.
I have a clip of the actual intervention, and it's such a perfect scene that it's like I barely cut anything out of it. It's just so good all the way through. So I have a clip.
Have a sheet,
Christopher. Hey, I'm Dominic. I know you don't know me, but
yeah, you're the guy who broke into Stu Leonard's that time. You stole all those pork loins.
Yeah, that
That's not why I'm here today. Christopher, we're here to talk about your drug problem.
What? Jesus Christ, you fucking kidding me?
Sorry, baby, please.
No, fuck this shit. You've been told once. Now sit down.
I mean, even better than like The Wire, and I think The Wire is one of the greatest television shows of all time, if not the greatest, but even in that, they treat recovery with a degree of respect.
Yes.
Whereas this is so, like, there's a little bit of respect, but it's like 90% this is how these characters would do it, which is completely flawed and fucked up. And of course, it would turn into like a shitty mall fight by the end of it.
It's like I said, it's grounded in reality for how these characters would behave in an intervention. Because, like, yes, there is boohooing and sadness and crying in an intervention, and you know, depending on who's there and who's speaking, because they do, that is a real thing. They read the letters, like
they do the pre-intervention
where they all get together and talk shit about you behind your back. At least that's how it felt at the time. I was like, so you guys, that's what I said at my intervention. I'm like, so you guys just all got together to like talk mad shit about me? What the fuck? Like, and Chris has the perfect reaction. No matter what the context is of what anyone is saying in an intervention, whether they're like, we love you, sweetie, or like, you're a piece of shit, you don't fuck me. The alcoholic is always going to be on the defensive, no matter what they're saying. Because that is in the nature.
I think anybody, because like, it's just a series of people giving their side of some disagreement you had, and you're not allowed to present your side. So it's just, you're getting like a bunch of one-sided accounts of the times that you were shitty. Who the fuck wants to hear that?
No one wants to hear it, especially if you're an addict.
And it's a genius thing about the intervention in general is, and it's the not just the nature of intervention, but it's also the nature of like 12-step programs in recovery, is the one person speaking at a time and there's no crosstalk and there's no like, it's not a conversation, because addicts, you know, you thrive off of manipulation. You thrive off of conversation. It's the only way you get to like weasel your way out of stuff, is to be like, okay, in my defense, I was, you know, I wasn't drunk then, I was sick, you know, something like that is part of being an addict, and not being allowed to do that. Oh my God, it makes you so mad.
Great. I can't even defend myself now.
No one's attacking you.
Look, it doesn't change anything, but I can verify that he was sick for a little while.
At my intervention, I woke up. There was near a single professional there. There was no one who was, it was just my friends. I woke up in the house that I was currently sleeping at that time, and they were all in the living room, and I went, all right, this is it, huh? We're doing the intervention. There was only one guy crying, and he cried the whole time. He's this very sweet man, this guy Nick, and I remember just looking at him being like, and I didn't say this at the time, but I was like, why are you crying? Yep. No one else is crying. Why are you crying? And I definitely pulled a little bit of a Chris, where I pointed out that, sure, I like to do heroin, but you guys drink every day, and sometimes you do cocaine, and you smoke weed constantly. Yeah. And I don't even drink that much. I just like heroin. So how am I any different?
You and Christopher are putting the whole system on trial.
Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, that was great when Christopher started putting everyone on blast who was there. Because, I mean, I definitely did a version of that at my intervention where, I mean, for me personally, mine felt, I was very much like a wild teen on Maury.
Yeah.
It felt like everyone was ganging up on me, and I was telling like, sit down. You don't know me. You don't know me. And like, I did have like professionals there. And the thing about, I knew we're smart. You can't pull one. Like, they really surprised Chris. And sometimes that is how it worked. But like you said, Matt, like, you were like, oh, this is what we're doing.
Yeah.
I knew what I was walking into. I had been around people in recovery before. I had been to a meeting when I was 13. Like, I knew the whole fucking deal. So I definitely did that, like, oh, boohoo, your life is so hard.
Yeah,
like,
right.
You want to know what I had to do last weekend to get high? Like, you know, fuck you. You don't even fucking know. And
yeah.
I mean, it was a mess.
He actually has dirt on all of them, basically.
Yeah.
Like some actual, like real dirt. And, you know, this is supposed to be like this time of openness. But of course, they're in the mafia. So the minute he does that, it's like, well, now you're a weak link and we have to beat the shit out of you.
Christopher, I love you very much. My only dream is that we have a happy life together. The last few months, things have got very bad with us because of you using drugs all the time. You're high all the time and I can't take it.
Be specific, hon.
When we first started going out, we made love all the time. Now, because of the drugs...
Jesus, is this fucking necessary?
Go ahead, Dejana.
You can no longer function as a man. Last week, when I came home to learn that you had killed our dog, that was the final straw.
Oh. You killed the dog? What'd you do that for?
It was an accident.
What was it, barking?
He sat on the woman's thigh.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
I fell asleep. She got suffocated or something.
You killed little Cosette. I ought to suffocate you, you little prick.
Tony, we're going in order. Sylvia?
When I came in to open up one morning, there you were with your head half in the toilet. Your hair was in the toilet water. Disgusting.
I told you I had the flu.
That's the best.
My favorite. Disgusting. It's not because it's not about. It's not about Christopher. You're sick. It's about you humiliated us.
Yeah,
that is not classy.
It's not even like you humiliated us. It's just like it was gross for me to have to see that, and I don't want to see that again.
Disgusting.
It's yucky. It's like everyone's reacting to their own special. Yes. You know, whatever their special weird idiosyncrasy is, like Tony loves animals and he can't stand the idea, and Silvio's a germaphobe, and Adriana wants to have more sex. It's not like you're killing yourself with drugs. It's just like, this is how you made me upset.
Right.
I mean, it's when they say that addiction and alcoholism is a family disease. Like, this is such a perfect example of that. Because everyone in this room is equally sick in their own ways. Chris just happens to be sick with alcoholism and addiction, but everyone else is such a fuck up still.
Yeah. It is wonderful to watch a bunch of other sick people. Like legitimately sick, fucked up individuals being like, you got to get your shit together. Yeah. And Chris sees, you know, obviously the hypocrisy in that. But in terms of like, you know, people's weird little idiosyncrasies, I think Paulie's is my favorite, absolute favorite, like intervention moment.
Paul, you want to read your statement?
I don't write nothing down. So I'll keep this short and sweet. You're weak, you're out of control, and you become an embarrassment to yourself and everybody else.
Oh, listen to you.
Guys, whoa. We said, non-judgmental.
Fuck that. Let him take his medicine.
Seriously, Paul, you want to talk about fucking up?
Watch it, Chrissy.
Why? I thought we'd be honest here. You got some balls, you know that? All of you. You want to talk about self-control? How about you, Sil? Fucking every slut you got working in the place. Uh-oh. When you got a wife and kids at home.
Guys, whoa.
Christopher.
Oh, you, Paulie. Yeah, remember last winter in the woods with the Russian guy?
Christopher, I'm fucking warning you.
There he goes, Mr. Type A personality.
We are here to talk about you killing yourself with drugs, not my fucking personality.
That's right.
I'm gonna kill myself? The way you fucking are, you're gonna have a heart attack by the time you're 50.
Oh, Paulie, sit down.
You're talking to the boss here.
Good, maybe someone will smack some goddamn sense into him.
Great, my own mother. Fuck you, you fucking whore.
That was the same thing that set Tony off when he was had to kill Ralph, was that Ralph made a fat joke about how much pork he's eaten.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know what the fucked up thing is? Chris was right. That's exactly what happened to James Gandolfini.
Yeah.
He died of a heart attack at the age of 51. He said, you'll be dead by the time you're 50. So, yeesh.
Yeah, I didn't even note that at the time until you pointed it out.
I just love the things that Tony like those are his, that is his last nerve, like with the animals or with his, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. I do love that in The Sopranos, like that, you know, weight and being fat is like, has a theme that's come up.
Yeah.
So many times, like with Johnny Sachs's wife. Yeah. Yeah, like, yeah. He's one of my favorite characters.
Yes. Yeah.
On the show.
Yeah. It means, you know, it's like these are the things, everyone's sensitive about different things in that intervention. And Tony's has always been both his weight and the fact that he's just weirdly obsessed with animals.
Right.
And likes animals more than he likes humans. So they beat the shit out of Chris, and then Chris is in the hospital, and one of my favorite lines is the person said, he fell while he was spraying for ants.
Yeah, he was wearing socks on the counter.
Well, he was wearing socks at the time. And she was like, oh, okay. And then, yeah. So basically, Tony, you know, threatens Chris into rehab, and Chris agrees after crying. And it's one way to do it. To be honest, it's like there's with this whole intervention episode, I look at it and I look back and I go, like, I understand the reason why you would think the best thing we can do here is threaten this guy's life, because it's like the yeah. one thing that everyone wants to do. I think with when you have a loved one who's like suffering with something that you think is in their control, like drugs or alcohol, you're kind of like your initial reaction is like, do we send him to jail? Or, you know, do we what if I just beat the shit out of him? Maybe that'll work. So it's funny that it ends up with him actually being in a situation where they're like, Patsy Parisi is outside in a hotel near the rehab. And if you try anything, then we're going to fucking kill you. So it's pretty beautiful. And yeah, I would have to say that if we're doing favorite, least favorite, well, Vince, tell me what's your favorite in this episode?
I mean, there's a lot of low key great moments in this episode. Obviously, like Silvio's statement at the during the intervention was great, but in terms of like a really just a like a subtle great moment, Furio always cracks me up, and just when he says I'm gonna go watch at the Bloomberg,
yes.
It killed me for whatever
wrote
reason
that down.
Yeah. It's a very great line. I mean, and then he goes like, they don't have the cable, which is oh, that's too bad. Let me see, Rachel, do you have a favorite or least favorite?
Well, now that we just listened to that clip, just how remarkable that whole scene is. It's like beat for beat. It's just like, it's like a choreography. It's just like so mm-hmm. perfect. It's like all, I don't know. It's just the way, it's not just the way it's written. It's just the actors. They're all just so fucking on point in that scene. It's
they're
just
perfect.
Like boom, 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 like all the insults. And then it just culminates in this, everyone getting the shit kicked out of them, everyone beating up Chris.
Yeah.
I just, and also just Tony's delivery of like, you killed the fucking dog.
Yeah.
Like he is fucking, like that was the last nerve for him.
Yeah.
Like that's, I just, I don't know. I like it. I mean, I know we didn't talk about Dr. Melfi, but yeah. I love the scene where he's in therapy and she's asking him about the animals. Like, what is it with you and animals? And he's having yeah. this vulnerable moment where he starts crying, but he's still being defensive, even though yeah. he's literally like, you can see him crying, but even yeah. through his tears, he's being defensive about yeah. why he's sensitive.
He kind of whines too. He goes, oh, well, you guys won't have to deal with me anymore, will right. you? You know, I just doubled up my Prozac. It just like, man, he's petulant, even in tears. Mm-hmm. Perfect, perfect child shit.
Oh, another yeah. really subtle moment that I enjoyed was, that Furio can't spell Meadows like the way he spelled her name, which was M-A-E-D-O, like Meadow. Hey, yeah. okay. This is a present for Meadow.
It yeah. took me until after that scene was over to realize he was trying to say Meadow. I was yeah, like, yeah. is that an Italian word? Like, yeah. what the fuck does yeah. that mean?
Yeah. Pretty amazing.
And also Carmela, like, crestfallen that there wasn't a gift in there for her.
Oh, so
like, she went digging through and she was just like, ugh.
She's like holding it upside down looking for the thing that's going to declare his love for her.
Oh, it's very cute, very sad. I would have to say, I mean, obviously the best scene ever is this fucking intervention scene. It is the most perfect scene in The Sopranos thus far. I would have to say it's number one. It's the funniest scene. Every character is just knocks it out of the park, and it's fucking perfect. I also very much so enjoyed, I enjoyed Junior's suggestion of just murdering him. Right. I thought that was great. And finally, I agree completely with what you said, Rachel, about like how the last straw really was the dog, the finding out the dog was murdered. And it's so telling because when he found out that Adriana had been hit by Chrissy, his reaction was, "What for?" Which is which is the greatest reaction that he would have, because it's like, it's not, you know, it's not necessarily, it's a question I understand for a second thinking of, like, well, why did he hit you? But it's also like, you would never ask that if you're in front of someone who got hit.
No.
Because it doesn't matter why, it's something an insane person does. But for him, he's like, well, there could be a perfectly good reason for you being hit. There's no good reason to kill a dog, even accidentally. So
right. And everyone else is like, was he barking? Was he barking?
Yeah, was he barking? Oh, that was wonderful. So all in all, I would say I have no least favorite scenes. It's a great episode. One of the best scenes ever.
My least favorite just because it didn't make sense with the FBI supposedly sending recovery brochures to Christopher's house.
Yeah.
And also see AJ being a little shit.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, I love that.
Watching AJ just being like cock blocking. It's so sick.
Yes.
Just a boring
cock. He wants
to go
to Comp USA.
To get a new magic stick. Oh, so 90s. I would say all in all, if I had to rate this episode on some sort of grade scale, I think I would give it a solid B+. Vince, what would you give it?
Wow, that's like a really bold grade that I would have never thought to give this episode, but like now that you say it, I really think it was a solid B+ of an episode.
No, all right, fair enough. Rachel, if you had to give this episode a letter grade, you know, what would you give it?
I like this episode a lot more than the one I was on, the episode we reviewed last time I was on, the Christmas one. So I'd have to give it a B+.
Yeah, that's fair. It's a solid B+ of an episode and a solid A+++ of an episode of Pod Yourself a Gun. Rachel Fisher, thank you so much for coming back and talking Sopranos with us.
Thank you for having me. I really enjoy your podcast and it was a blast talking about this episode.
Absolutely. Well, it was a blast having you on. Where can people find you and listen to your podcast?
I have a podcast called Hollywood Crime Scene. We talk about crimes related to celebrities or crimes taking place in Los Angeles. It's anywhere you listen to podcasts. And yeah, that's where you can find me, or on Twitter at The Rachel Fisher.
Check out Hollywood Crime Scene Podcast for all of your Hollywood crime scene content that you could ever want. Thank you again for coming on. Frotcast@gmail.com for all your questions, comments, concerns. Vince, before we get out of here, we have, listen to this, 5 new Pod Yourself a Shout Out patrons.
I didn't put these on there.
They're on there.
I know, but I didn't get to preload these before the show. I think I gotta come up with these boom on the fly. I mean, I've basically been doing that anyway, but
yeah, you gotta right off the top of your head. First, we're starting with his name is Brett Sheebish.
Oh, Brett Sheebish. We call him the wolf because he's a she bitch.
Oh, that's pretty good. I like that. All right. Next is Sarah Farnbauch.
Oh, the farm bitch. We call her. All right.
They can't be Brett Sheebish and farm bitch.
Call her Billy Goat because she's a farm bitch.
All right.
It works. Billy Goat, that's a good nickname.
Yeah, that works. Sarah, the Billy Goat. Next we have, and this was a shout out bought by Scott Grabel to his fiance, Bridget Boyle. So Bridget Boyle.
Oh yeah, we call her Boyle. She's we call her the zit.
way to go. Congratulations, Scott.
Yeah, congratulations.
Congratulations. I'm marrying the zit.
Yeah, and happy birthday. It's Bridget's birthday. Oh, that's why.
Happy birthday to the
happy
zit.
Happy birthday, Bridget, the zit. Let's not. All right. And Brooke Magny.
Oh, Brooke Magny, Magnum PI. We call him Selleck because he's the Magnum. He's the Magnum.
Yeah, Magnum PI. Yeah, I get it. You get it's it. Pretty good. Hey. And finally, Josh Walters.
Hey, we got big fat Josh coming over here. I don't know if he's got a weight problem or if it's maybe an ironic nickname. We call him, he's so skinny, Big Fat Josh.
Big Fat Josh over here. All right. Well, patreon.com/fraudcast.
I'm just joshing over here.
Just joshing. The $8 tier, pod yourself a shout out, gets you a shout out on the podcast. Once again, that's patreon.com/fraudcast. Fraudcast@gmail.com. Finally, sorry, before we do go, I did want to give a real quick shout out, to our $10 patron, Barry Leach. We'll call him Barry. Give him a name real quick.
Hey, he's the Leach. I mean, that's a freaking gimme right there.
That's a gimme. Barry the Leach. Barry pointed out to us that we have not done a free Fraudcast in a while. I want to just point out real quick that when Pod Yourself a Gun season starts, then all of our Fraudcasts go into just being Patreon only. So for all you Fraudcast fans out there who are like not yet, every episode with the Pod Yourself a Gun, just as soon as the season is over, there will be free Fraudcasts for all. So Barry, thank you for pointing that out. We love you. Fraudcast@gmail.com. Vince, what's the Google voice number?
415-275-0030.
All right, everyone. Thanks again so much for listening. And until next time, don't stop believing.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Get all the Masterforce outdoor power equipment you need to maintain your yard at Menards. Own the outdoors with Masterforce 80-volt power equipment, delivering all the power of gas without the maintenance. The entire 80-volt line is powered by brushless motors for ultimate performance and productivity. From lawnmowers to leaf blowers, string trimmers, and more, find everything you need to create the lawn of your dreams with Masterforce power equipment at Menards. Save